Made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Watch for your Krannert Center 2005-2006 season brochure the first week of May, and visit KrannertCenter.com for the most current Krannert Center news. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
Nothing I can do, or nothing I can say, that folks don't criticize me. But I'm going to do just as I want to anyway, and don't care just what people say. If I should take a notion to jump into the ocean, ain't nobody's business if I do. If I go to church on Sunday, then cabaret all day Monday, ain't nobody's business if I do. If my man ain't got no money, and I say take all of mine, honey, ain't nobody's business if I do. If I give him my last nickel and it leaves me in a pickle, ain't nobody's business if I do. Well, I'd rather my man would hit me than for him to jump up and quit me. Ain't nobody's business if I do. I swear I won't call no copper if I'm beat up by my papa. Ain't nobody's business if I do. Nobody's business. Ain't nobody's business. Nobody's business if I do.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, a discussion about America's blues women. So we opened there with Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do. Billie Holiday, recorded in August of 1949 with the Decca Studio Orchestra featuring Lester Young. Ma Rainey's piano player, Thomas Dorsey, said, "The blues is a good woman feeling bad." But Buzzy Jackson points out that the songs Dorsey wrote for Rainey suggest a corollary to his definition. The blues could be a bad woman feeling good. She says his Memphis-bound blues is but one example. As Ma Rainey sings it, "I talk because I'm stubborn. I sing because I'm free." Buzzy Jackson is our guest this afternoon. She is the author of A Bad Woman Feeling Good, Blues and the Women Who Sing Them. In the book's introduction, Jackson says the women blues singers of the 20th century helped women everywhere find their own voices. She says, quote, "These singers discovered truer versions of themselves when they broke society's rules about how women should act, look, sound, and feel. They refused to follow the rules of good behavior and in the process earned some scandalous reputations. Bad women? Perhaps. But being good had never gotten them anywhere." That from the introduction of Buzzy Jackson's book, A Bad Woman Feeling Good. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Buzzy Jackson earned her Ph.D. in history from the University of California, Berkeley. A Bad Woman Feeling Good, Blues and the Women Who Sing Them is her first book. The publisher is W.W. Norton. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The numbers to call if you'd like to join the discussion. Look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. Buzzy Jackson, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's really nice to be here.
Your book opens at the outset of the 20th century with women including Ma Rainey, and I suspect one of the women in the first chapter is someone many people will not be familiar with. I had never heard of her. Mamie Desdumais.
Yes, Mamie Desdumais. That's an approximate pronunciation of her name. I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. But she came up, you know, and I first heard about her when I was researching this book, in the oral histories and kind of memories of people who were in the New Orleans jazz scene around the turn of the last century. And she's cited in a couple different places as somebody who was playing a really special kind of music, an unusual kind of music, on piano in the Storyville district of New Orleans, which was kind of the red light district there. A lot of people, including people like Jelly Roll Morton, cite her as the first person they ever heard playing what would later be known as the blues. And she was quite a character from what we can tell about her. She played in a brothel there in New Orleans. And she was kind of an entertainer. She may have also been a working girl in that brothel. We don't really know. Mm-hmm. But she's sort of one of the figures who emerges from the shadows of blues origins. It's always it's kind of a lost cause to try and pinpoint the exact moment or person when who was there when blues was invented. But her name came up quite a few times.
Yeah. It is wonderful, though, to think about what she might have sounded like. At the same time, it's bittersweet because we just don't know, although you quote Jelly Roll Morton as saying, "The one blues I can never forget happened to be played by a woman."
Yeah.
And that was Mamie.
Yeah, and to me, that's, you know, it's significant. Well, for one thing, it's significant that Jelly Roll Morton said that because he's kind of known as, you know, beyond just his musical talent, he's not known for giving anyone else credit for inventing anything. So he spent a lot of his career, you know, trying to make sure people knew that he was the inventor of jazz and things like that. So that seemed pretty special that he would single her out. And also that, you know, he cites a woman as being one of the first people to play this kind of music. And I think so often in the story of blues music that gets told, it's really a story with very few women in it. It's usually a story that starts in the Mississippi Delta and sort of goes through a chain of male guitar players, basically, and with very, very few women appearing in it at all. So that was part of the reason, you know, I was interested in writing this book, is to offer a little bit of a corrective to that and to show that women have been a part of not only blues music throughout the century, but also of the really central part of the recording industry and popular music in the 20th century as well.
Yeah. It was interesting when I went through my record collection and looked over collections that were, you know, like about a history of the blues kind of a thing, that there are few and far between women in these, what would you call it?
Like anthologies.
Collections, anthology.
Yeah.
tribute records, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The women are few and far between. You have to go and find a recording that's all Billie Holiday, or
right,
you know,
right? Yeah, I think that it's unfortunate, and it's kind of it's a little mysterious to me actually why that should be. I mean, I think what tends to happen is, in terms of just the marketing of blues music, and I would actually say of a lot of popular music, American music in general, women artists tend to get grouped together in a way that men don't. So they'll say, you might find a collection of like great blues women of the 1920s, you know, and there'll be some little liner note about how the 1920s were a great time to be a blues woman. And then there's nothing else until, you know, the 1940s and the great women jazz singers or something. And you even see this in contemporary music, I think, with things like, you know, the Lilith Fair or something. And it'll be like, it's a great year for women in music. You know? And it's like, well, they've been in it every other year.
You know? So, hey, kids, it's a great year for music.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, and they never do that with men. You know, they never say, boy, it's a great year to be a man in music. But I guess every year is a great year to be a man in music. No, that may be the underlying theme there. But it has something to do with marketing, I suspect. But, you know, that's why it was important for me to, in this book, I really try and draw a sort of linked kind of genealogy, if you will, that of women musicians and artists who influence each other in a kind of unbroken line through the century, because there's no decade that really gets left out in this book, and that's just a more accurate, I think, representation of women's participation in music, because there never has been a decade when they were not active, you know. So
yeah,
that was a big motivation for me.
Well, it may be, you know, ain't nobody's business if I do, but you know, you note at the outset that many women who sang the blues didn't do it openly at the start. Now, of course, that changed.
Mm-hmm.
When did it change? Why did it change?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there has always been a tension, and I don't know if this is exactly what you're referring to, but the tension between sacred and secular music, and that a lot of women who were active, say, in church singing, like in gospel music, and I'm talking about the African-American community here mostly, but a lot of women were really active singers in the church, and they did not sing anywhere else besides the church. And so the idea of singing the blues, which owes a lot of its musical structure and sound to sacred music, was a big no-no for a lot of women, and for men too, I should say, but especially for women, I think, because they were held to a higher standard of decorum and piety and that kind of thing. So I think, especially in the beginning of the 20th century, for African American women, there was a real movement to sort of lift. It's kind of complicated, but basically to sort of lift people's perceptions, white people's perceptions of African Americans, by presenting a public face of African Americans that was very decorous, that was very respectable, and all these things. And so blues music just doesn't fit into that structure, obviously, because it talks about drinking and sexuality and lots of things that are not allowed in the church, obviously. But I think, you know, in the 1920s, when the recording industry sort of started to develop a little bit more, the recording industry had a big hit with a woman singing sort of a version of the blues called Crazy Blues, and it was such a big hit, it made so much money, that I think it's one of those instances where, and we see this, I think, in American history from time to time, where actually sort of the pressures of capitalism overcome other pressing issues, and suddenly it seems like a really good idea to have women singing the blues, and it really was a breakthrough for women. It gave them a lot more opportunities to express themselves through this kind of music, and that's how people like Bessie Smith, for example, became such a huge recording star in the 1920s, because she sold so many records that finally people couldn't really argue with it. You know, people just loved her music, whether it was you know, a bad thing or a good thing. It was just fun to listen to.
Yeah. Well, back to the idea of the blues being sort of a profane music.
Yeah.
You know, it came out of sporting houses and barrel houses. Those were the words that used to describe barrel houses, just a house with a piano in it, and no doubt there was drinking in barrel houses. And then the sporting houses, music, alcohol, and prostitution.
Yeah.
So, but on the other hand, when you start to think about the sacred and the profane, both genres are musics of liberation, if I could put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, that's, that's part of what is so powerful about blues music. It really, it took so much from you know, early forms of gospel music and church singing, and especially, you know, that idea that the singer could really transport his or her audience through this song, through the identification with the singer and the journey that he or she is going on. And, you know, that was something that Bessie Smith, for example, really identified with. She was definitely not a religious person, and she didn't, I would say she never struggled with whether or not she should, you know, sing secular music, unlike, I think, some singers who kind of struggled with it. Bessie Smith didn't really care. But she was a big fan of Southern preachers, mostly because of their performative style, and she learned a lot from them. And she would say, when she was young, she was an orphan, and she would perform on the street to help support her family. And when people would throw money into her little box as she sang and danced on the street corners of Chattanooga, Tennessee, this is in the late 1800s, she'd say, "That's right, Charlie, give it to the church." And, you know, it's a pretty sacrilegious thing to say. Obviously, she wasn't singing church songs, but she definitely identified with that whole style of being the person who can connect with the audience, you know, and really make her problems their problems, you know, through song or and vice versa.
Yeah. And a contemporary of hers was Ma Rainey. We should mention her, I think, as well this afternoon.
Yeah.
She was a wild woman.
definitely. I mean, Rainey actually, you know, she was a little older than Bessie Smith, and she had been performing before Bessie Smith started. She really represented sort of a link between sort of 19th century kind of popular music, which was basically sort of a more vaudeville, sort of minstrel style. She performed in a traveling all-black minstrel show called the Rabbit Foot Minstrels. And she did, her songs and her sort of overall performance were really almost more of something we would associate now with like a variety show. She would sing, then she'd do like a little comedy act and maybe a little skit, then sing another song. And she toured all around the South and was just a huge folk hero for the people who saw her. The way she looked needs to be described, because it was also an influence on Bessie Smith. She had a really outlandish kind of stage appearance. She had rows and rows, just ropes, I should say, of pearls, fake pearls, gold coins, kind of a gypsy-like assemblage of clothing and feather boas, and then she had all these gold teeth and this kind of crazy hairdos and headdresses, and she was just outlandish, especially, you know, in the context of the late 19th century little farm towns she would go through. But people just adored her, and she was the one who actually first gave Bessie Smith a job when Smith was about 14. Rainey hired her as a dancer, not a singer initially, and became really like a mentor to Bessie Smith, and just taught her a lot about how to perform, how to interact with her audience, probably taught her a lot of songs, that kind of thing. And while Rainey, she did eventually recorded quite a few records in the 1920s, she always kind of remained more of sort of a folk artist in a sense, whereas Bessie Smith really transcended that and became kind of a symbol of the jazz age and sort of a Harlem Renaissance kind of figure, much more sort of urban audience.
Yeah. In their stage appearance, I think this is fun to think about, is, you know, they adopted this feather boas and pearls and gold and tiaras.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that come down through time. I think it's wonderful. I mean, you think of Dinah Washington.
Oh, yeah.
And you think of Queen Latifah.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, or Janis Joplin.
Janis Joplin, okay.
Yeah, you know, completely. I mean, I think that's why I think, you know, that's one of the real overlooked aspects of a lot of these early women performers, is how much they influenced just the way, just sort of performance styles and you know, not just other women either. I mean, if you think about the way, you know, Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin performed, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, and sort of the sort of glam rock of the 1970s, and, you know, David Bowie and people like that in you know, feather boas, sparkly outfits, all of that kind of thing. I mean, it's really, I wouldn't say that, I'm sure David Bowie wouldn't claim Ma Rainey as his main fashion influence, but I think that there is something to be said for, you know, where this kind of really flashy, kind of crazy look came from. And, you know, Rainey and Bessie Smith both exemplified this look, you know, 70 years before Bowie did Ziggy Stardust. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's not, we shouldn't just stop at other women, you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, you know, I don't know about David Bowie, but, you know, thinking about Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, and yes, it's show business, but it also says, you know, respect me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I'm a woman of some power here.
Yeah, it does, and it really, it's a really bold move to adorn yourself like that. If you're an African-American woman in the late 1800s, early 1900s, because, you know, this is just one generation out of slavery, and this is a time when African-Americans are being lynched in greater numbers than they ever have been for the so-called crime of thinking that they're too good for their status, you know. And the idea that a black person would have the temerity to get up on stage and assert herself like this, to sort of draw attention to herself in such an overt way, instead of, you know, getting off the sidewalk when a white person walks by, or never looking a white person in the eye, or any of these things. And of course, and I'm talking, of course, about primarily about the South, and that's where these women were mostly performing. It's really a radical act to do that, and that's one of the reasons why these performers were so beloved by their audiences, because they were brave enough to get up on stage and really, really be aggressive personalities, and that was something that was just such a taboo at the time. It's really hard for us today to fully understand that, I think, but it was an incredibly courageous way to be.
Yeah, well, going back to Thomas Dorsey's lyric, Memphis Bound Blues, I talk because I'm stubborn, I sing because I'm free, stubborn and free.
Mm-hmm.
And you write, these words are essential
to
understanding the power of the early blues women.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really, you know, when you start reading and understanding about, you know, what life was really like for African Americans after slavery, especially in the South, you know, yeah, it was wonderful to not be a slave anymore, but it wasn't like life was suddenly this free pass. And in fact, the crackdown on black culture and just black sort of activities in general was so incredibly harsh. I mean, this is the beginning of the Jim Crow era. So I think these ideas of being stubborn and being free are really, they're at the heart of what black people wanted at the time and were so rarely able to achieve without white retribution.
Mm.
Yeah.
So in the music, we have an expression of, anger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we might be listening to a lyric that on the surface of it is about, you know, something,
right,
but underneath, something else is going on as well.
Yeah, Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, as you brought up earlier, I think this is really linked to the kind of church singing that blues really drew from, which was, you know, during slavery times, you'd have hymns about the Lord delivering his chosen people from Egypt, which was a really clear sort of metaphor to African Americans of being delivered from slavery in the United States. And in blues music, yeah, I think you have that too, where you have, sometimes it's a kind of funnier and just purely entertaining thing. It might be some really, rude sexual metaphor that crops up a lot in blues music. But I think a lot of times, yeah, it might be a song about a relationship between a man and a woman and her desire for freedom or her struggle in that relationship. And that could also just be a metaphor for the black experience in white America, too, you know. So I think there's several layers going on there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think blues music is not as overtly political as, let's say, some forms of folk music that we can think of that are obviously, union songs and things like that. But I think it has a real political content in the sense that it really embodies the idea of making the personal political, because it is about personal lives and personal experiences, and singing that to a large group of people and having them respond to it makes that a political act, because everyone kind of understands that and sort of joins in on that event. So I think it's a subtler thing in blues.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Buzzy Jackson, author of A Bad Woman, Feeling Good, Blues and the Women Who Sing Them. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to hearing from you. Your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, rock and roll owes a lot to the blues, and that is can be a very political music as well.
Yeah.
And, like the Rolling Stones, I mean, you can hear the blues, if it's not been borrowed, it's been stolen, but
yeah.
It's there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, it's similar too with rock and roll. I mean, especially if you think about the beginning of the rock and roll in the 1950s, just the fact that a certain type of popular music can mobilize a specific sort of group of people is a sort of a political act in itself. I mean, with blues music, you have a certain kind of music that really speaks to the African American community, and that is, and of course, it speaks to the white audience too. But I guess I'm just saying, it was bought in such large numbers by African Americans in the 1920s and 30s that that in itself is kind of a big demographic event. With political ramifications, and that, of course, was true also in the 1950s, with sort of rock and roll and the discovery of the American teenager as a marketing force. That suddenly people really had to pay attention to this group of people who hadn't really been singled out before. So I think that's one kind of less commented upon sort of link between those two genres, for sure. Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say there's certain rock artists and sort of rock influence artists who were, more political, more obviously political than others. But I think just the fact that they're sort of working in this genre sort of links them together, yeah. Mm.
Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Aurora online. Four. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So that music was from the 20s and 30s?
Well, the music...
The one you played at the beginning.
The one I played at the beginning, that was recorded in 1949.
Yeah, but it's actually a cover of a Bessie Smith song that was first recorded in the 1920s.
you can tell by the words.
Yeah.
That is a very, well, it's a song you hope you never hear again. That the black woman was beaten and she really didn't care.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That was her business.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's all I want to say. I think it's a sad commentary, you know, that we're hearing it again, and somebody might be listening and saying, gee, I guess it's okay, because we know that in DuPage County there's something like 7,000 spousal abuse cases, and you just don't want to hear it anymore or know that somebody's singing about it, even if it is an old song. So that's my comment, and I guess I sound a little like, you know, I guess I wish there wasn't spouse abuse anymore. And that's all my comment. And I know you put this on more for a show how they sang and how they got ahead and in singing, but I guess I picked it up from another place. Sorry. Bye-bye.
No, I think that's an observation a lot of people would make, and I think that the caller's concern, you can hear it in contemporary music today.
Yeah.
Same thing's going on.
Yeah, you know, it's especially with somebody like Billie Holiday, who really sang... She sang quite a few songs that had lyrics like that about, you know, if my man beats me, I won't call the cops, or it's okay that he hits me because I know that he loves me kind of thing. That is, it's really disturbing. I totally agree with the caller. And, you know, that song, which was a Bessie Smith song originally, Bessie Smith had a couple of songs like that. It was different when she sang them, I think, because she had... her persona was one of such strength that when you heard those songs, it was almost like it was hard to take it seriously coming from her. Coming from Billie Holiday, who always sounded so vulnerable and so fragile, and of course, if you know anything about her life, you realize that it actually was pretty true to her life in terms of having a series of very abusive relationships. It's really an ongoing mystery, I would say, to her fans as to why, first of all, as it is to, I think, to many of us, you know, why people stay in relationships that are so abusive. And, there's lots of reasons, of course. But then why sing about them in a way that kind of memorializes them in such an artful way? You know, all I can say about that is that it is upsetting. It is disturbing. And it's also something that it was a really accurate portrayal of her own life, of Billie Holiday's own life. And for that may have been the sole reason that she sang about it, was just to be honest about what the pain that was really in her life. And I don't know. I do agree with the caller that... that it's very upsetting to hear it. I think we hear it less in today's music. You know, I think we hear it more in some forms of music that sort of glamorize violence against women. Then there were some songs in the 60s. There was a famous song, "He Hit Me and It Felt Like a Kiss," that was a big hit in the mid 60s. That was actually co-written by Carole King, if you can imagine that. And you know, so these songs and these themes do come up from time to time in American popular music, and I guess maybe they'll keep coming up as long as, this kind of abuse is a part of our culture.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Let's not dwell on the difficulties that the blues create for white middle-class women. I'd rather ask you to go into some detail about the relationship between Ma Rainey and Lovie Austin and Tampa Red. I mean, Ma Rainey's one of my heroines, and if you'd be such a good person to do that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
You know, I feel like I don't have a lot of great information for you about, specifically about their relationship. And mostly what I go into in the book is mostly about Ma Rainey's relationship with Bessie Smith, because that was such a long time relationship for both of them. And it was one of musical mentorship, but also a lot of people said it was a romantic relationship. And it may have been. I think that's one of those things that will be impossible to ever know for sure. But certainly, I'm sure there's a lot of great information out there about her relationship with other blues women like Lovie Austin. I don't think I'm the person to give it to you, though, unfortunately. Sorry about that.
333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Buzzy Jackson, author of A Bad Woman Feeling Good, Blues and the Women Who Sing Them. The book is published by W.W. Norton. Here's a question you ask late in the book. If it doesn't exactly sound like the blues, look like the blues, or call itself the blues, yet it sort of feels like the blues, or at least reminds you of it, is it the blues? And you say the simple answer is yes. You want to give us maybe a little bit more?
The less simple
answer. Yeah, the less simple answer.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I really came around to in researching this book was the influence of the blues, not just in purely musical terms, not just looking for a tradition of people who played, the same kind of blues notes or used the same musical scale, but who really carried on what I call in the book a blues attitude. And I think that's really one of the keys to understanding blues music. I mean, people who are in the world of blues, whether they're musicians or critics or anyone else, they're constantly being asked, to define the blues. And most of the time, blues musicians will say, it's really more of a feeling than anything. And I think what they're getting at there is that it's a sort of attitude toward life that really permeates blues music and the subsequent sort of musics that come out of it. This blues attitude, to me, I think, is characterized by, for one thing, it's a really personalized style of, in this case, I'll talk about singing, since I'm talking about all singers here. It's a kind of singing that really, it's a far cry from the kind of popular music that was popular in the 1920s when blues started being recorded, which was sort of more operatic and sort of stagey. It's really using a voice that's a natural kind of sounding voice. And that makes sense because the content of blues lyrics is always about people's real lives. It's not escapist in the sense that it's not about like a Cole Porter song that's sort of a fantasy of rich people on the Riviera. It's escapist in the sense that it allows you to escape into the fantasy of the singer's real life. Their loves, their losses, how tired they are after a day of work, those kinds of things. And it kind of transforms the everyday life into something that's really epic. And of course, the other main thing about the blues is that it's so emotional. It has such a strong emotional content. And so all of these things put together, plus more, you could say more about the blues attitude, really had an influence on a lot of different genres that don't, on the surface, sound like blues. I mean, for example, Billie Holiday is often referred to as a blues woman. If you listen to a lot of her songs, there's something bluesy about them, but they're also breaking new ground in jazz. Or somebody like Aretha Franklin, who is singing ostensibly in what you could say is the genre of soul music. Mm-hmm. But there's always a kind of blues style to her singing, and so I think that's where I'm going with that, is that a lot of artists, even people like Joni Mitchell, Patti Smith, are sort of taking on this mantle of really speaking truth to power about their own lives in a really upfront, kind of aggressive way that is totally bluesy in its style.
Yeah, it was interesting to read about Joni Mitchell here. She's here within the pages of A Bad Woman Feeling Good, and you say, you know, she has this in common with those who came before her. She's using her artistry to become more fully herself.
Yeah.
And not to hide out.
Right, right. And I think that's the key, especially when we're talking about women artists, is that it's a sort of style of a sort of approach to art that is not trying to, you know, feather boas aside, is not trying to be somebody else, is trying to really be just purely themselves. And, you know, Joni Mitchell, I mean, she's constantly cited as this, you know, great American artist, but she also really got a lot of flack, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, for writing what people thought was music that was too confessional, you know, that she was really putting too much of herself and her personal relationships into her songs. And her response was just to keep doing it, you know, and that's why I put her in here, as well as people, even people like Courtney Love, who, you know, people kind of, certain people see her name in the book and think, what in the heck is Courtney Love doing in this book? And, you know, the argument I'm making is not that Courtney Love is a traditional blues woman, but that she is carrying on a tradition that the blues woman started of putting herself out there and taking a stance that says, I really don't care if you like me or not. You know, I really, I just am going to do this and express myself, and if you like me, great. And if you don't, great. You know, I don't mind. And that is really unusual, even in this day and age, for people to do in popular music, especially for women, I think. So that's why some of those artists are in there,
yeah.
For sure.
Well, before we run out of time, talk with us a little bit about Lucinda Williams.
Yes, Lucinda Williams. Well, I spent a little time with her in the end of the book because, for one thing, her music is, like, unlike somebody like Courtney Love, it's more obviously derived from the blues. She's a huge blues fan and really is very influenced by blues artists as well as other types of music. But I think that she really exemplifies sort of bringing some of the traditional ideas of blues and even sort of sounds of blues into modern sort of rock and roll, basically. She said that, I did a long interview with her for the book, and she was saying that, you know, part of her problem is that record executives never know how to what category to put her records in. And in fact, she's been nominated for Grammys, I think, in folk, rock, and country. And she said, you know, they put me in folk because that's where they put artists who they like but who don't sell any records. And so now I think she's breaking through a little bit more. But, you know, she's really trying to take some of the lessons of blues music and bring them into a more sort of contemporary sound. As she told me, you know, she loves blues music so much, but if she was just going to write a standard traditional blues, she might as well just sing a Howlin' Wolf song because nobody is going to do it better than that. So I really admire her for sort of sticking with her musical convictions. It's been a long road for her commercially, but I think she's finally kind of breaking out now.
Hmm. Who are the women that are performing today that you think, besides Lucinda Williams and, who else could we talk about here?
Bonnie Raitt. You know,
Bonnie Raitt, yeah. Joni Mitchell.
Right.
Queen Latifah comes to my mind.
Yeah.
Who else are you a fan of?
Yeah, I mean,
contemporary.
Yeah, I think that one thing I don't talk about too much is women who are doing more traditional sort of blues thing. And there are, I don't talk about them too much in the book, but there are some terrific blues women out there who are really trying to maintain those earlier styles. And that would be people like Rory Block, who is terrific, Susan Tedeschi. There's also, of course, blues singers who have never stopped performing, who are still doing the things they used to do, and are terrific. People like Coco Taylor, or even Etta James, who started her career in the 1950s. But since she was so young when she started it, she was only about 14, that she's still performing today, and she's still a terrific performer. So I would really encourage people. She tours constantly, too. So I would encourage people, if they ever get a chance, to see Etta James. to do it, because she's just amazing, and she has a real diverse sort of sound. She does bluesy stuff, she does rock stuff, she does a lot of Billie Holiday, actually, who is one of her idols. So that's just a smattering of people, but yeah. But yeah, I think there's a lot of great women out there sort of carrying the torch.
Yeah. I wish we had more time. We've used it up. It went quickly.
I know. It was fun. It was fun.
Buzzy Jackson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Buzzy Jackson is the author of A Bad Woman Feeling Good, Blues and the Women Who Sing Them. The publisher, W.W. Norton. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Some money. This is Todd Gleason, and the update from the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange look like this for the day. In the wheat pit, the May contract today settled up 2 3/4, had a high of 314, a low at 308 1/4, and a settlement price at 310 3/4. July futures at 324 high, low at 318 1/2, and they settled at 321. They were up 3 1/4 for the day. September contract now 331, the high, the low at 326 1/2. And a settlement price there at 328, they were up 3 1/4. December futures 341 1/2 high, low at 335 1/2, settled 337 1/2, up 3 cents. And the March futures at 349 1/2 high, low at 345, settled 346. They were up 3 cents for the day. In the corn pit, futures finished the day about 1 1/4 to 1 3/4 higher for the day. May futures were up 1 1/4 with a high of 211 1/2, a low at 209. Settlement price there at $2.10 3/4 cents, up 1 1/4 for the May. July futures up 1 1/4 as well with a 219 settlement price. They had a high of 19 1/2 and a low at 17 1/4. September futures $2.26 1/4, the high, the low at 224 1/4, settled 225 3/4, up 1 1/4. And your December corn, 235, the high, low at 233 1/4, settled 234 3/4. They were up 1 3/4 for the day. March futures 242, the high, the low at 240 1/4, a settlement price at 241 3/4, up 1 3/4. And the May contract at 246 high, low at 244 1/4. May corn for next year settled 245 1/2, up 1 1/2 for the day. Of course, during the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, about all that's happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange today and in the last week or so, and what he expects to come in the near future. May oats now 156 3/4 to high, the low at 154 1/2, a settlement price at 156. They're up 1 3/4. The closing market report, of course, starting about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. 155 was the high for the July oats today, the low at 153, settlement price at 154 3/4, up 2 3/4. From the soy complex now, 640 the high for the day in the nearby May, the low at 626, settlement price at 630 3/4. They were down 0.25 cents. July futures unchanged today, 639 the settlement price, 648 the high, the low at 633 1/2. And the August futures, 645 the high, the low at 633, settled 637 1/4. They were unchanged for the day. September contract in the bean pit, 640 the high, the low at 627 1/2, settled $6.31. They were down 0.5 cent. And the November futures were down 2 3/4 today, with a settlement price at 626 1/4. November's had a high of 637 and a low at $6.22, a fairly wide trading range for that contract. January beans, 639 the high, the low at 623 1/2, settled 627 1/2. And they were down 1 3/4 for the day. Bean meal futures now, the nearby May contract, 197 the high, the low at 193, settled 194.90, or rather 194.80. They were down 0.10 for the day. July futures were off 40, and 198.50 the high, the low at 193.70, and the settlement price there at 195.30. Once again, that July bean meal contract down 40 for the day. May bean oil now, 23.07 the high, the low at 22.51, settled 22.66, they were down 17. And July bean oil, 23.35 the high, the low at 22.71, settled 22.87, they were off 21. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, let's start with April feeder cattle. The high today, 111.30, the low 110.60, the settlement 110.95, that up 10. May, 107.85, the high 106.82.5, the low. The settlement 107.07.5, the settlement, that down 45. August, the high 108.80, the low 107.70, the settlement 108.22.5, that down 17.5. April live cattle, 91.47.5, the high 90.80, the low 91.10, the settlement, that up 55. June live cattle, 86.07.5, the high 85.25, the low 85.52.5, the settlement, that up 12.5. May lean hog, 75.70, the high, the low 74.57.5, the settlement 75.55, up 40. June, 78.70, the high, 77.20, the low 78.37.5, the settlement, that up 70. July, 78.95, the high, 77.20, the low 78.60, the settlement, that up 70. August, 76.50, the high, the low 75.20, the settlement 76.25, that up 67.5. May bellies, 85.60, the high 83.80, the low 85.25, the settlement, that down 70. And let's take a look now at the Dow. It is currently down 57 points at 10,071. The S&P 500 off 10 points at 1143.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Becky Elder from Manitou Springs, Colorado writes, Dear Dr. Science, how come when I'm camping, the smoke always blows towards one particular person, no matter where that person moves?
Smokes into revenge in a big way. It never forgets an insult. Believe strongly in an eye for an eye. It's easy to see that smoke gets in your eyes if you've somehow wronged smoke. But once it's started in on you, getting smoke to lay off is awfully difficult. Crying uncle will get you nowhere. You can run, but you cannot hide. Smoke is nothing if it's not persistent. Most insults to smoke come from non-smokers, and that's why cigarette smoke always drifts towards the non-smoker. Back when they allowed smoking on airplanes, I always watched with amazement as the smoke sped down the aisle towards the non-smoking section. Now you can only observe that kind of thing in restaurants.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary live show on DVD, go to drscience.com.
WILL, Urbana, NPR, and more for Central Illinois. It's timely market information and agribusiness analysis. Get the information you need from the Agricultural Information Advantage.
And the closing market report is coming up this afternoon following the news from National Public Radio. A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for much of northern Indiana until